doing a series in 1 Corinthians, and I've got a broad title for what I had to say to you, which is a contentment that can bring change, a contentment that can bring change. And it is dealing with the secret things. It's the heart, the matter of the heart. We're really getting down to the matter of the heart. For those of you who've been following the series, we're in chapter 7, which is page 807 in the Church Bible. And the reading there was from verse 17. And when we're looking at 1 Corinthians, we're looking at a deeply troubled church. And any group of people that you ever come amongst, and some of us are going to be going out and Christmas parties and all sorts of things. You come amongst groups of people, it might be an office party, I don't know. But whoever they are, you come amongst, you can sense in a group, when you come amongst a gathering of people, what's going on. You get a sense of a group, don't you? Sometimes a group of people that you would normally expect to have been, you know, really enjoying themselves, very relaxed, you don't know that so-and-so and so-and-so are at odds, and there's been a bust-up 5 minutes before you walked into the room, and there's this stilted atmosphere, and you expect it was going to be an enjoyable evening, and you come away just thinking, what was that all about? It was so oppressive. There's a sort of a heaviness hanging over everything. What's going on? And was it me? Was it them? What's going on? People go to churches, don't they? And I sometimes use my imagination. I was thinking about this church in Corinth. What would it have been like to go to the church? You've come to Corinth, you're there on business, you've checked out the website, it's Gospel Church, Corinthian First Baptist Church, whatever it is, you showed up there, preaching Christ crucified or something, you arrive, and it's like, I just think it'd be really odd. You kind of, I think I'd come away from the service really confused and thinking, there's something not right, there's something amiss in that group of believers. There just wasn't a sense of God. There wasn't a sense of the Spirit at work. It's as if, they're Christians, and I know they open the Bible. I wasn't comfortable with the teaching. It was just a real atmosphere in the place. And it was just an unhappy ship. And there are people whose professional lives, and I think there's a couple of people in this room who've actually been involved in this kind of work, and corporations and so on, they get a problem in their culture, don't they? They get a kind of a heaviness. They're not as being as productive. You look at their CVs. You were talking about this the other day. You look at all their CVs. They're all highly qualified. They've been great high achievers. And yet, for some reason, they're not clicking. They're not working well together. They're not being productive. You get whole departments in offices. It's just not happy. What's going on? I think that's what the kind of thing that you'd find coming into this. And these professionals come into, what's the problem? They do counseling, they do motivational speaking, they do one-to-ones, group sessions, trying to uncover the issues, apply their skills to try and ease the process, get down to the bottom of things. We're looking at a passage here where the Apostle Paul is addressing a church like this, where it's restless. There's a sort of an unease. There's just a lack of peace. What's the problem? What really is the problem? We've been looking at very specific items here as we've been going here, specific issues Paul's been talking about. But here from verse 17 onwards, he's laying down a principle. You can see it there in verse 17. He says, this is the rule I lay down in all the churches. This is a universal principle. He applies it in every church, every circumstance. This is Christianity. Without exception. And he sort of steps aside from dealing with specifics to teach a principle, a fundamental principle that each one of us has got to be reconciled to and digest and accept. That basically when we're looking at what's the problem in the corporate life, let's start by looking at you. Let's start by looking at me. Let's let God examine our hearts. Where are you today? How is your soul today? Because in the end, every group of people is just the sum of the individuals that make it up. And I know there are group dynamics and all the rest of it, but in the end, the one irreducible thing is just you and me and how all these things add together. And in the church in Corinth, That's where he started to move in. In other words, he's going into the dark place. He's going into the human heart. We admire surgeons, don't we? The heart surgery, and it's made such incredible progress of late. It was a mystery into the 1600s. People didn't even know what the heart was. It was just so delicate, you couldn't touch it. So they just left it alone. And it was only literally in the last 50, 60 years that anybody, and I was hearing on the radio, this amazing guy, people said, you just can't even experiment with the heart because, you know, the patients won't live, and so you can't even experiment. One guy put a tube into one of his arteries and ran the tube up his artery into his own heart and offered himself to be a living experiment. He was a doctor. He got sacked for it. And 20, 30 years later, he got a Nobel Prize for medicine because he basically invented cardiology because he said, I'll explain. Here's my heart. And the lives that have been changed as a consequence of that groundbreaking openness to that examination of his heart. And in the end, in church life, in spiritual life, it's our hearts. What can we do? We can just say, here we are. Here's my heart. Would you work in my heart? It's a bold thing, isn't it? It's a brave thing because the heart is the place where it's the seat of our emotions and our thoughts and our feelings and our desires. There's nothing more personal than the heart. I don't really do moral outrage very much. I don't really get into it very much. But this last week, I've just seen some photographs, and they are so disturbing, really. And I know it goes on in America, but this is England, you know. Black Friday. We didn't really hear much about Black Friday, did we? Until this last week, it has arrived. Black Friday has arrived. And I think the photograph that summarized it all for me, and the photographer must be some kind of a genius. They took a photograph of what I think was a loading bay. You know, sometimes you go and buy the goods at the front of the shop, and they say, come around the back and we'll give them to you. And I think it was a loading bay, and there's a member of staff in something like an Argos. And he had these big thing seems to be the flat screen TVs, doesn't it, this time around, right? And he had this stack of flat screen TVs, and he was handing them out to the people on the other side, outside the loading bay. And all these people were crammed up against the loading bay, and they were reaching out for it like this, right, to receive their flat screen TVs. And of course, the genius of the photograph, what do we normally associate that image with? It's usually a United Nations relief agency lorry piled with rice and people starving as the man unloads the truck and people are just for the very stuff of life. And the thing about it was exactly the same passion. Exactly the same sense of need. The great sense of feeling and emotion as if their very life seemed to depend upon it. And you want to go at a moment like this, you just want to say, let's just put on sackcloth and ashes and get and humble ourselves in the dust and say, God, what has become of us? What has become of us? Lord, have mercy. Can't we see? Have we lost all proportion? Have we all lost all sense? You know, you can have as many flat screen TVs as you like in the end. We lose it all. We have to give it all up. Our meaning, our purpose is not in these things. We must know this. Hey, they're not going to make you. You know, actually, when you get the thing home, it's all the ripping off the carpet. It doesn't work. And then you can't get the channel. People are swearing and frustrated. You get a little bit of time. You get interrupted because you've got to go and do it. It's not going to bring you happiness. That's not where happiness comes from, is it? And these people here, these people in this church in Corinth, their passions, their desires, their lusts, their needs, their wants are so overpowering that if this was the line of the love of God and the sweetness of everything he's done for you and all the tender mercies there are in the giving of the Son, the giving of the Son. Parents, the giving of your one and only Son, who you love, the greatest gift. They have trampled over that line. They've crossed that line in the pursuit of so many mean and base things, leaving the gospel so trampled on that it's almost unintelligible in their community as they pursue their passions and their desires for this and that. And there is no sense of Christ and the love of God. What's their problem? What's besetting them? Why are they so, as individuals, why are we so unhappy? Why is our society so unhappy? Why were the Christians in Corinth so unhappy and lacking contentment when God has been pleased to give them so much? What's really bothering them? One of the great advantages of being a preacher is that you can use stories and illustrations over and over again. And because people don't often remember your sermons, you can tell them again and they don't realize. You've heard my cheeseburger story several times. Anybody remember the cheeseburger story? Sean looks at her. She with weary, weary resignation. So I was working a shift at McDonald's, in a big, busy restaurant full of families and lots of young children getting their McNuggets, their little dose of cholesterol. Right? And this lady came in, "I want a cheeseburger. Please could I have it without mustard?" Reasonable request. "No problem, madam." Call into the kitchen. "One cheeseburger, no mustard, please." Later, the cheeseburger arrived on the top of the shelf, all wrapped up. "Is that the one with no mustard?" "Yes, no mustard." Handed it to the lady. Took her 99p. She opened it on the counter there. She opened it. She looked inside it. You know what I'm going to say? That was mustard. She exploded. She exploded. The expletives. There were children everywhere. Families and children happily eating their meals. And it was blue. And violent and loud. Right? This is the point. The problem wasn't the mustard, was it? Why is she so unhappy? Because she hasn't got mustard on her burger? Because nobody's listening to her? Because everything seems to be going wrong? What is it? What is it that makes that one thing finally cause her to explode? It wasn't enough just to replace the burger, was it? We had to be there almost to rescue her life. In McDonald's. But that's where God wanted me to be, right there. Out there. Isn't that where we're supposed to be? Out in the world. Not of the world, but ready. Ready to do his will. Wherever we are. When there's no mustard on the cheeseburger. Good. There are really good doctors around, thank God. And there are great police officers, and there are great teachers. There's some really remarkable people around who are doing fantastic jobs. And I think it's a bit like if we talk about it as a really good friend. The thing about these people, what holds it all together is the fact, the way that they really understand the situation. They look beyond the symptoms and the superficial things that are apparently in the light, and they get into the secret place. That friend who you complain to and you moan and you say, "Oh, it's this and this," and "Oh, you won't believe what they said." And what's really the problem? Why are you unhappy? And then you can pour out your heart. You can tell them what's really wrong, and they'll understand. And they'll help you. James, a couple of decades before this letter to the Corinthians was written, wrote a letter to his congregation, and they were in a very unsettled situation. And he asked them the question, why are you fighting? Why are you fighting? What are you fighting about? And the answer was, because there were things that they wanted. These things that they wanted. They wanted them so bad. And the reason, he said, well, why don't you pray about it? Well, the reason they don't pray about it, because they knew that these things weren't what God wanted for them. You know, those things that we want, that we know God doesn't want for us, and that's why we can't pray about it, because we know that it's not his will. Isn't it? Lord, will you buy me a Mercedes Benz? You know. It's just not like that. It's just not like that. And when we do ask, when we do finally say, give me a Mercedes Benz, you know, you start telling God what you want, because deep down you just know it's not God's will. You know it's not his plan for your life. And you start demanding, and then when he doesn't give it to you, you get cross, you get angry. What's wrong with your heart? What, your desires, the misguidedness of our desires. We were talking the other day, weren't we, Richard, about the difference between, how can you tell the difference in your heart? The heart is a very, very tricky little organ, isn't it? Very delicate. How can you tell? How do you know whether the things that you want, even if it's an unsettledness, that unsettledness is a holy unsettledness, a God-inspired and led unsettledness towards a further pursuit of doing his will? Or how do you know if it's God, and how do you know if it's you? How can you tell the difference? It's quite a fine line sometimes. Sometimes you have to get a cigarette paper and you can put it between the two, and you can't really tell the difference between whether this is what I want, is this what you want? And I think it's, the reason is partly like this, and Adele was here this morning, and she's quite clever. I'm sure some of you are horticulturally clever as well. But if I've got a tray out here and I put a whole load of seeds on the tray, how many of you would know, looking at those seeds, which one's going to be a tomato and which one's going to be a cucumber? Anybody clever that way? They all look the same, don't they? All these little, mean little things, you know. They all look the same. And sometimes when we look at our hearts, that's what it's a bit like. It's very hard to tell the difference. When you read on the packet, it says these ones. When you see, what fruit is it going to produce? That's the key thing. And when you look at the desires and the passions and the things that are in your heart, you've got to say, what's the fruit? Where's this going? What's the consequences going to be? Jesus was very helpful about teaching us that, wasn't he? Look at the... who's going to get encouraged if I do this? Whose name is going to be honored if I do this? Whose house is going to be built if I do this? Whose glory is going to be enhanced if I do this? And if you start asking yourself these sort of questions, suddenly it becomes a little bit more apparent whether this is indeed the will of God or just your flesh. Just your flesh. So, these people here in the church, they're struggling, aren't they? They're struggling. They have no contentment. In their hearts, they're not happy doing the will of God. So let me just ask you a question. Just say, let's propose, that it is possible to know God's will for your life. Okay? It is possible to know God's will for your life. And let's just accept that for a moment. Imagine you get a little envelope. It's got your name on the front, and it says, your name, God's will for your life. And it arrives on your doormat on a Monday morning. Let me ask you, how many of you rush to tear open the envelope, open the contents, read it, and read it again with joy and thanksgiving, like a Christmas present? Or how many of you are like, I think that's God's will for my life. I'll open it tomorrow. I'll open it like this. What's it say? Honestly, what's it like? What's it like when you think about it? Is it like, this is the most exciting letter in the world? The key of happiness and contentment is contained in these pages. Or is it like a bill? Who's this letter from? The one who's given his son? What more could we want from somebody? What greater protest of love can there be? What more could you ever ask of God? I say this almost in every sermon, don't I? whatever more could you ask of God than he gives you his son? He's done it. So can you not trust that the contents of this letter will be absolutely the key to your happiness? Does he love you? Does he love you? This is the question, isn't it? This is the question. And that's what the apostle's doing to these Christians. He's directing their hearts to being content in what God's will for their life is. He's trying to bring the truth to light. If they could just be reconciled, what would it be like? Tell me, let's imagine that service is very, you've gone to this very awkward service on a Sunday and you've come away really confused about what's going on down there at First Baptist Corinth. But because there isn't another church in town and you think, well, I really ought to go to church on Sunday, the next church service comes around. But that previous Monday, every member of that church received this letter with God's will for their life, and they each read it, and they spent the week praying over that letter until every single one of them was reconciled to do whatever God had called them to do. And then they met again the following Sunday. How different would that service be if individual by individual, heart by heart, person by person, each one came saying, Lord, the answer is yes. Here I am. Here I am, ready to do your will. How different would it be coming amongst that group of people? It's the same people. It's the same people, isn't it? But what a different heart. What a different spirit. Because essentially what we're saying is this. He's talking about their circumstances. They should retain the place in life that the Lord has assigned to them, which God has called them to. That's the rule that he's laying down in all the churches. Look at your circumstances this morning. Maybe that's not a very pleasant view. I don't know. Look at your situation. Look at the people around you. Look at your bank account. Do a quick health check. Look at the economy. Look at the society that you're part of. Just have a look. That's the place. This is the life. This is your mission field. This is God's will for your life right now, today. And that is quite a searching thing, isn't it? And he's not just picking on the Corinthians. And that's why it's important to preach through the Bible, isn't it? Because I'm not preaching this because there's a particular thing going on here in the church. It's because this is a standard rule and a law for the church through all ages, through the world, isn't it? Just look at our life, whatever it is, and realize, right now, this is your mission. This is your mission. To live out your Christian life here and now. And they're all different, aren't they? In verse 18, you can see, some of them are Jews. Lots of Jews here today. Being a Jew is wonderful. Okay? Most of the time. Being whatever you are is wonderful. Most of the time. There are advantages and disadvantages. There are good things, there are bad things about whoever you are, whatever you are. There are people here in this letter. Let's look at these letters. Who's he writing to? Is he just writing to a comfortable group and saying, you know, live the life that God knows? Some of these people, they're slaves, it says in verse 21, is it? Did you hear me? Slaves. Latest statistics, there are 13,000 slaves in this country. Slaves in the United Kingdom today, as we're all sitting here in freedom. 13,000 people without their liberty. And if this letter was being received to them, they'd be hearing, this is your mission. This is God's call. And yes, some of them, it says in verse 22, they're free as a bird. Free as a bird. They can do what they like. Keys of the city. So he's scanning right across society and all the different races and the people who belong, the people who don't belong, the foreigners and the natives. People, doesn't matter who you are. Right now, live the life that God has given you. Live it. When I was growing up, my mum always used to say to me, she'd say, Mum, if you're listening, I haven't forgotten. believe is be alive. Live. Live. Without exceptions. And this church that he's writing to is fragmented, they're immature, they're immoral. Why? What is it all about? Here's all the symptoms. These are all symptoms. What is it? They do not love their mission. They're not reconciled to the call that God has on their lives to be the person they are and to live it for Christ in whatever situation they're placed at that moment in time. They're unsettled. They're just not saying yes. Yes. How do you know God's will for your life? How do you know? There's different ways, aren't there? There's this. This is the revealed will of God. So 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12. In every circumstance, give thanks. And then it says, for this is the will of God for you. That one gets me every single time. Every single time. In every circumstance. That's the revealed will of God, isn't it? And then there's also the providential will of God. Here you are in that body, in this seat, in this place, with what you know and who you're connected to. This is providence. And you have to bring those two things together and live for Christ. Live for Christ. That's what they're reading. And yet they're struggling. They want to be somebody else. They want to do something else. I wish I was in the Bahamas. Trudy's going there. But unfortunately, it's not that easy. There's nothing wrong with going to the Bahamas. God bless you. Send us a postcard. But we can't just go, can we? Because we're finite. We don't have enough money, or we can't have the time, or we've got commitments and responsibilities. We cannot just live the life we want to live. We can live the life that God has called us to live. And that is a world of difference, isn't it? And it will keep us from being eternally frustrated unless we're always looking over our shoulders at other people and how they're living and what they're doing and what we have to live our lives. Verse 17 calls it our assignment from God. See, the emphasis is not on changing your circumstances. It will not make you happy. You've got to use your circumstances. You've got to use your situation in the service of God. Steve Levy was preaching the other day. No, it's Paul Levy, actually. And he was saying that he'd been in Korea, and there was about 80-somebody people in this one of these huge, great big churches in Korea getting baptized. And one of the guys got up there. He was a very old chap, and he came up there on his crutches like this. And as everybody came up, you could feel this flutter of excitement going across the congregation. So he asked, you know, what's the excitement? What's all this about? He's a very, very famous scientist. Old man, very famous scientist. And at the end of his life, there he was, giving his life to the Lord and wanted to be baptized. People were so excited. Then he said something in Korean. Everybody burst into tears. What's going on? Why is everybody crying? He just said, I want to thank Mr. Parkinson for introducing me to Jesus. He'd been strong, self-confident. When he became ill, he started to feel his vulnerability for the first time, and the Lord brought him to a place. I'm not saying you have to get, please, you know I'm not saying you have to get Parkinson's to find Christ, right? Just give your life to Jesus, here and now, right now, today, okay? But in his personal experience and story, he had to come to a place of weakness before he was ready to cry out in dependence and need and cry out to God, and God saved him. It'd be better, wouldn't it, to go to heaven having suffered Parkinson's than live a long, healthy, strong life and go to hell. And he was very thankful. And, you know, talking to Hannah recently. She's young. Hannah's young. And, you know, you can look at this different. Hannah has cancer. But as her father was saying, Hannah has Christ. every circumstance, but by the grace of God. Have mercy, O Lord. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil. But nevertheless, as Jesus said, not my will. Your will be done. Your will be done. It's not kind of, this isn't a kind of fatalism, is it? This is not a kind of fatalism. Saying, oh, you just got to accept everything and know, I'm sick, I'm poor, I'm a slave, I'm this, I've got a rubbish relationship, everybody's nasty to me, you know, this is my life. That's not what it's saying here, is it? It's not what it's saying. That we look there in verse 21, were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. You know, be at peace. Christ has chosen you. You're free. He loves you. But then it says, although if you can gain your freedom, do so. This is really, really important because there was a very critical discussion that took place in the 18th century about slavery, and I don't think this was made as much of as it need to have been by certain people. This is not just saying, oh, you've just got to accept your lot in life. Please, please, if you're oppressed, if there's oppression, if there's evil, if there's injustice, fight it, challenge it, change it. Roll up your sleeves. Make this world a better place. Speak for those who can't speak. Do for those who can't do. But do it out of a profound sense of being doing it in the will of God. Not to make the world a place, because only then, when the world is a better place, will I have peace and contentment. Because that is the road to frustration and vexation of spirit, isn't it? Because the world is a wicked place. And with all our best efforts, it will remain so till Jesus comes. But that doesn't mean we don't do everything we can in the love of God to do what we can to make this world a better place. And if you can obtain your freedom, you do it. And do it with all of your power. With God's help and strength. But, you know, the fact is that these people were in those situations. That was their situation. They opened their little parcel. What was it? Was it the Mission Impossible? It's a Mission Impossible where they got delivered a little kind of package or something like that, and they opened it up and said, this thing will self-destruct in 30... Well, I can't remember, you know, how many seconds or something like that. 3, was it? Quickly read it. 5 seconds, this letter will self-destruct. And will you accept this mission? See, the difference here is that whether you accept this mission or not is irrespective, because in a sense, this is the mission. This is your life. This is who God has made you to be. The difference is, if you accept it and you say, yes, Lord, the way you live that out is going to be completely different. The person who spends all their energies, all their precious energy, fighting God, just fighting God and hating God and resisting God, and I want it differently, and I want to be somebody else, and I hate my face, and I hate my body, and I hate my life. You know, when kids, they kind of come at you, and you put your hand on their forehead, and you're building up their muscle, they put your hand on their forehead, and they're swinging at you like this. They can't quite reach you. You can't beat God. You can't beat him. He's God. But you can stop fighting and throw your arms around him, let him throw his arms around you, and you can do this together. And he'll never leave you. And he'll never forsake you. Imagine if Christianity was just for the fat cats, it was just for the middle class, it was just for the wealthy. Can you imagine what it'd be like? Well, firstly, what about Joseph? Joseph ended up in a slave. He ended up in prison. The whole of redemption history would have been absolutely short-circuited at that point. We have to be prepared to suffer. I'm not saying it's all going to be suffering, but I'm just saying if it is, we have to be able to accept it. Jesus did. Are you looking forward to heaven? Does that sound all right? That's where he came from. I wouldn't want to leave. Would you want to leave once you're there? Say, now, I want you to leave. I want you to go to
Slough.
Or Bethlehem. Or Nazareth. Or Jerusalem. Calvary. We went. The mission. We have a call on our lives. The reward is absolutely, you know that thing where there's fantastic meals been put on the table. And you want, with everything that's inside you, is like going, just have a bit of that. You know? You don't want to wait till everybody's sat down and is sitting and comfortable at the table. There's everything in your life. Just take the cherry off the top of the cake. Nobody will. Rather than just doing what you have to do first. Happily, contentedly, and then we will have our reward. We will have our reward. It's difficult, isn't it? You've been made in the image of God. What incredible gifts you have. How talented you all are. You're so blessed in so many ways. And yet, we have to suffer so many things to enter into the kingdom. It's not precious stuff, is it? It's not precious stuff. Now, you've got to invest it. Invest it. So, okay, I'll round up. Do you accept the call? Got my mobile phone here. There's a call coming in. You can see it displayed now. You can see the number, can't you? He's got your number. You look. Are you going to accept the call? Are you going to do his will? Or are you just going to go, I'm in a meeting? They're struggling in Corinth with the call of God on their life, and they're unhappy, and they're fighting and striving to get everything else. It's not working. They want to write the script and be in charge. They want to be God. There's something in all of us that wants to be God. Playing God. The serpent came along in the garden, isn't it? Adam and Eve there, they had it all. But along came the serpent. If you eat this, you'll be like God. And it was like, yes. It's so subtle. It's so subtle. The temptation to, if I open that letter, he'll ask me to do something that I'm not going to like, or that won't have eternal consequences into it. You know, that's the point, isn't it? But do something, if you just read that letter and do it, just do it. That faith pleases God. Tim was talking about that faith that pleases God. Doing it his way, here and now, rich or poor, Jew or Gentile, man or woman, God's way. Because I know at the moment, I mean, I struggle with God a lot. I don't know I know that you're more spiritual than I am. Especially you, right? But I struggle with God a lot. And the moment I stop struggling, I have power and strength. That's the way it works. I wasn't picking on you particularly, by the way. It was just a rhetorical device, just so you don't take it personally. That's where your freedom comes. Your freedom. Freedom to follow Christ. And the man who's free, and the truth is that most of us are pretty free, aren't we, by comparison. The Old Testament has those stories about the men who would offer their ear and say, if you drive an awl through my ear into your doorpost from that point onwards, I will voluntarily be your slave. I want to be your slave. I actually don't want to leave your house. I don't want to leave your side. I don't want to stop serving you. I love being here. I love your family. Here I am. Will we do that with our freedom? What are we going to do with our freedom? Will we serve Christ with it? Imagine if the church obliged everybody to be Jewish. You had to go through the whole rigmarole of conversion and all the rest of it, okay? In order to be so, or actually if you were Jewish, you had to stop being Jewish and everybody had to convert and become a Gentile. Or Trudy, you're always dressed very, very well. Imagine if all the women of the church had to dress like Trudy. right? Okay? Otherwise, you can't take communion. It's that simple. Or who should we build our image around? Who is everybody's got to conform? Imagine if everybody has to conform. We all have to be one. We all have to look the same. We have to talk the same. We all have to wear check shirts, short sleeve check shirts. Whatever it is, the little cultural signals or whatever it is, because that really is Christianity is for people like that. And if you want to be in, then you've got to conform. You can't be you. You can't dress the way you dress. You can't like the music that you like. You can't enjoy the food that you... You've got to conform. What kind of church is it like where it's a uniform? It's all uniform. What would that say about Christ? What would that say about the gospel? The gospel is for people like this. But the amazing thing about the gospel is for anybody. And when they see it's you that's received Christ, and you that's received Christ, and you, and you're all so different, they sort of, hope rises up. Could Christ, could he do it for me? Died he for me? And then the church is built. And there is conformity. We do have to conform to Christ. If we're all so different, but there's something about you that's like Jesus. There's something about you that's like Jesus. There's something about you that's a church, isn't it? What a church that would be. What a service. When you go around and the people, just there's a sense of Christ. A sense of Jesus. So, do we accept the mission? Do we accept the mission? That in the end, this is about accepting God's love for you, actually. Was letting the love of God enter your heart. Verse 19, keeping the commandments is what counts. Doing his will. We do his will because we know he loves us and we know we can trust him. And he's our Father and we are his precious children. And we're safe. We're safe. What are we going to sing, Andy?